The topic of our lecture is the concept of the structure of the world in Old Testament times. You and I would not hesitate to join in the confession of faith made by Ezra the priest almost 25 centuries ago and preserved through these centuries in the words of the Old Testament in Nehemiah 9:6. Thou art the Lord, thou alone. Thou hast made heaven, the heaven of heavens, with all their host, the earth and all that is on it, the seas and all that is in them, and thou preservest all of them. But when you and I use the terms heaven and earth and seas to designate portions of the created cosmos, do we understand these terms in the same way that Ezra did back in the Old Testament era? Is our modern concept of the structure of the created world in any way like that of Ezra, or of Isaiah, or of Moses, or of other individuals in Israel's ancient times? In addition, we ask, is the portrait of the physical world which is reflected in the pages of the Old Testament one which was in any way unique to ancient Israel, or does it have any points of relationship or similarity to the Weltbild of other nations of the ancient world? These are some of the questions we shall investigate in this discussion. First of all, let's take a brief look at some selected samples of the concept of the world among non-Hebrew peoples in biblical and pre-biblical times. The history of ancient Egypt can be traced back to at least 3000 BC, which takes us back more than 1500 years before the formation of Israel as an independent nation at the time of its exodus from Egypt. During the 15 or more centuries preceding Israel's exodus under Moses, the people of Egypt had formulated their concepts of the structure of the created world as they knew it from their everyday experience. Professor John Wilson of the University of Chicago, one of the leading contemporary Egyptologists, has published diagrams visualizing the ancient Egyptian concept of the world, from which this drawing on our screen has been adapted. Let me give you Professor Wilson's own words in which he describes the Egyptian concept of the structure of the world. He says, in speaking of the Egyptian's concept of the world in which he lived, we are going to try to give this in a single picture, which will have only partial justification. In the first place, we are concerned with something like 3,000 years of observed history, with the vestiges of prehistoric development partially visible, and there was constant and slow change in this Weltbild across this long stretch of time. In the second place, the ancient Egyptian left us no single formulation of his ideas, which we may use as nuclear material. When we pick and choose scraps of ideas from scattered sources, we are simply gratifying our modern craving for a single integrated system. That is, our modern desire to capture a single picture is photographic and static, whereas the ancient Egyptian's picture was cinematic and fluid. For example, we should want to know in our picture whether the sky was supported on posts or was held up by a god. To this, the Egyptian would answer, yes. He would simply say, yes, it is supported by posts, or it is held up by a god, or it rests on walls, or it is a cow, or it is a goddess whose arms and feet touch the earth. You see, any of these pictures would be satisfactory to the ancient Egyptian according to his approach, and in one single picture, he might even show two different supports for the sky. For example, the goddess whose arms and feet reach the earth, and the god who holds up the sky goddess. This possibility of complementary viewpoints applies also to other concepts held by the ancient Egyptians. We shall therefore pick a single picture in the knowledge that it tells a characteristic story, but that this is not the only story which the ancient Egyptian would tell as he explained his understanding of the structure of the ancient world. According to the picture on our screen, and in Professor Wilson's words, the Egyptian conceived of the earth as a flat platter with a corrugated rim. The inside bottom of this platter was the flat alluvial plain of Egypt, and the corrugated rim was the rim of mountain countries which were the foreign lands. This platter floated in water. Below it were the abysmal waters on which the platter rested, the waters called by the Egyptian Nun. Nun was the waters of the underworld, and according to one continuing Egyptian concept, Nun was the primordial waters out of which life first issued. Life still issued from these underworld waters, for the sun was reborn every day out of Nun, and the Nile came pouring forth from caverns which were fed from Nun. In addition to being the underworld waters, Nun was also the waters encircling the world, the great ocean which formed the outermost boundary, also called by the Egyptian the Great Circuit or the Great Green. Thus it was clear that the sun, after its nightly journey under the world, must be reborn beyond the eastern horizon, out of whose encircling waters, just as all the gods, had originally come forth out of Nun. Continuing with Professor Wilson's words describing the picture on our screen, he says, "For the Egyptian, above the earth was the inverted pan of the sky, setting the outer limit to the universe. As we have already said, the craving for symmetry, as well as a sense that space is limited, called forth a similar counter-heaven underneath the earth, bounding the limits of the underworld. This was the universe within which man and the gods and the heavenly bodies operated, according to the ancient Egyptian way of thinking." Various qualifications to this picture are immediately necessary. Our picture shows the vault of heaven as suspended by apparent levitation above the earth. There's no visible means of support, and that would appeal to the ancient Egyptian as something very dangerous, and he would ask for some visible means of support for the vault of heaven. As we have already said, he provided various means of support in his different ways of thinking about this or picturing it, and if these were incompatible with one another, he simply cheerfully ignored that fact. The simplest mechanism which the ancient Egyptian thought of as a means of holding up the vault of the sky was a set of four posts standing on earth in order to carry the weight of heaven. These four posts were at the outer limits of the earth, as is indicated by such texts found in ancient Egypt, which read, for example, quote, "I have set the terror of thee as far as the four pillars of heaven," unquote. And the number four suggests that these four posts were thought of as being placed at the four points of the compass, north, south, east, and west. Fortunately, this arrangement appealed to the Egyptian as being both strong and permanent, for a simile or a comparison that is used more than once among the ancient Egyptians is this statement, "Something is as firm as heaven resting upon its four posts." Now we change to picture number two, also a way in which the ancient Egyptian envisioned the structure of his world. You see, We have already said that for the Egyptian, heaven might have other support than the posts of which he frequently made mention. Between heaven and earth, there was Shu, the air god, and it was the function of Shu to stand firmly on earth and carry the weight of heaven. In one of the pyramid texts, it is said, quote, "The arms of Shu are under heaven that he may carry it," unquote. Significantly, another version of this text gives a variant reading which says, quote, "The arms of Shu are under Nut that he may carry her," unquote. For heaven, according to the Egyptian, was of course personified as a deity. In this case, heaven was the sky goddess Nut. Nut is represented as crouching over the earth with her fingers and her toes touching the ground, while the sun, moon, and stars adorn the underside of her body. She may carry her own weight in this pose, or the air god Shu may take some of her weight on his uplifted arms, as is shown in our picture on the screen. This concept of the firmament, or the vault of heaven, as a personified sky goddess Nut, has been represented pictorially in quite a number of drawings and inscriptions found in ancient Egypt. The picture on our screen is a copy of an Egyptian coffin drawing which corresponds to the descriptive statement of the pyramid text already read, quote, "The arms of Shu are under Nut that he may carry her," unquote. So here, the arch of the firmament is represented by the body of the goddess, whose fingers and feet rest on the horizon east and west, while the central part of her elongated body is supported by the air god Shu. The earth on this picture is represented by the reclining figure of the earth god Geb, who, according to Egyptian mythology, was the brother of the sky goddess Nut. As Professor Wilson has already reminded us, the vault of heaven, the firmament, in the thinking of the Egyptian, might be represented as the underbelly of a vast celestial cow, with the forelegs and the hind legs of the cow standing at either end of the flat earth. And as the Egyptian looked up into the sky and saw this firmament represented by the underside of the cow, he envisioned it as being studded with stars. In fact, he even spoke of the Milky Way along which the sun might make its heavenly course. The fact that these differing pictures of the world were essentially alternatives didn't seem to bother the ancient Egyptian, for in the course of a single text he might use these differing ideas about heaven, and each concept would please him, and each would have its pertinent value in a universe which was fluid and in which almost all things were possible to the gods. Within his own standards of what is credible and convincing, the ancient Egyptian had his own consistency. All of his concepts of heaven and of its supports were designed to give him assurance instead of uncertainty, because each one of them was stable and enduring, and one concept could be taken as complementing or supplementing another instead of contradicting it. It is important, too, to keep in mind that for the Egyptian, the heavenly bodies, the stars and the sun and the moon, which were conceived of as traveling across the face of the firmament, all of these heavenly bodies were regarded as deities, gods or goddesses. The moon god was Thoth, and similarly the stars each had their importance as being deities or goddesses of major or minor importance. As we move on now to our next slide, we come to a concept of the structure of the ancient world as it was held among the Babylonians of ancient times. In addition to Egypt, you will remember, another ancient Near Eastern nation which had numerous contacts with the Israelites was Babylonia, or Assyria-Babylonia, off to the east of Palestine, located in the region of Mesopotamia between the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers. While the Israelites had certain points of contact with Mesopotamia, by virtue of the fact that their ancestor Abraham had come from that very region, they also had continuing political and cultural contacts with the people of Assyria and Babylonia. The Assyrians and Babylonians, as a matter of fact, were also Semites, like the Israelites, descendants of Shem. And so they might actually be regarded as relatives of a sort, if only third or fourth cousins. The history of ancient Babylonia goes back also to at least 3000 BC, with its first period of flourishing dated in about the 25th century BC, again taking us back at least 1,000 years before the beginnings of Israel as a nation. These ancient Babylonians also had their ideas about the structure of the physical world in which they lived, and from documents which they wrote on clay tablets and which archaeologists have discovered and deciphered in relatively recent decades, we are now able to reconstruct what their understanding of the physical structure of the world was. Like the Egyptians, the Babylonians, too, were ready to express their conception of the created world in various ways. According to one view, the firmament, or arch of heaven, was regarded as being made from the body of an evil goddess named Tiamat, who was the goddess of the great deep, who represented the negative forces of watery chaos and destruction. According to Babylonian legend, the creation of the world took place when the god Marduk overcame Tiamat in a bloody struggle, a struggle in which he split her body in two from head to toe. One half of her body Marduk stretched out to form the flat earth, while the other half he arched over the earth to form the firmament. As in Egypt, so in Babylonia also, the flat, circular earth was regarded as standing in water and surrounded by water. On the basis of Babylonian documents, an eminent Assyriologist named Professor B. Meissner, about 40 years ago, produced a sketch of the Babylonian concept of the structure of the world on which this diagram on the screen is based. Here the earth is conceived of as a flat disk in the center of the ocean, a disk on which several layers have been superimposed, much in the manner of the artificial step mountains or ziggurats built by the Babylonians. This earth disk, which was sometimes called the cosmic mountain, was envisioned as floating on the sea, and in turn, it was surrounded by an encircling ring of mountains at the outer edges of the sea. Above the earth is the arched firmament, in which the Babylonian documents speak of at least three layers, or three heavens, shown as the first heaven, the second heaven, and the third heaven on our diagram. The depths of the sea go down below the earth, and beneath these depths are located the underworld, at the lowest levels of which is the kingdom of the dead, the final destination of all men. The Babylonian visualization of the world included the notion of cosmic waters which surrounded everything else. This is indicated on our diagram as the heavenly ocean. Another student of Babylonian literature adds the following details regarding the Babylonian world picture. He says, "On the outside of the vault of heaven, which had the form of an inverted bowl, forming a solid hemisphere above the earth, was the region where the sun passed the night and where the moon stayed during the days when she is invisible to man. On the east was the mountain of sunrise, and on the west was the mountain of sunset, and each had a door." This, by the way, is similar to the understanding which we find reflected in the Old Testament in Psalm 65, verse 8. The description of the Babylonian worldview continues in these words: "The sun opened the eastern door in the morning and disappeared through the western door in the evening. The stars also had their places in the vault of heaven, and likewise there were located here the celestial originals of the great cities and the great rivers of Mesopotamia." Listening to this kind of description of the physical structure of the world, it becomes obvious to us that the Babylonians formed their understanding and their portrait of the world in part on the basis of their own experiences and observations in their daily life, and in part on their imaginative speculations about those parts of the physical world which lay beyond their realm of experience and personal contact. With our next slide, we turn now to a reconstruction of the understanding of the structure of the physical world as it was held by the Hebrew people of the Old Testament, an understanding which is reflected in the writings of the Old Testament scriptures. I have made an attempt to visualize this Weltbild by means of the diagram which you see on the screen, which is titled Concept of the World in Old Testament Times. You have also received a set of duplicated Old Testament references which provide the biblical basis for this diagram. On the diagram, the solid mass of the earth, represented by the dotted area across the center of the page, left to right, is designated by the number 1. It is, by and large, a flat earth which is supported by pillars, designated on the diagram by number 2. Pertinent biblical passages here are statements like those of Isaiah 42, verse 5, and Isaiah 44, verse 24, which speak of the earth as being spread out, and in both cases, the Hebrew text uses a verb which means to hammer out or to flatten out. And by its very use of this verb, the Hebrew text thus gives expression to the typical Semitic view that the earth was a spread out or flattened out mass of ground. That this flat earth rests on pillars, which serve as its foundations, is the view expressed in passages like those given under number 2 in the list of Old Testament references. Notice that the list of passages includes references to earthquakes, which in Hebrew thought were related to the shaking of the earth's foundation pillars. This is how the ancient Hebrew explained the quaking of the earth. He thought of it in terms of the pillars of the earth being shaken. Some of the passages include statements like this. For Samuel 2, verse 8, "The pillars of the earth are the Lord's, and on them he has set the world." Or a passage like Psalm 75, verse 3, which speaks of the earthquakes. "When the earth totters and all its inhabitants, it is I who keep steady its pillars." Or we have a similar statement in Isaiah 24, verses 18 and 19. "The foundations of the earth tremble. The earth is utterly broken, the earth is rent asunder, the earth is violently shaken. The numeral 3 on our diagram designates the waters of the great deep. These were the waters over which the earth was pictured as being stretched out, the waters into which the earth's foundation pillars were sunk. Such waters are referred to in passages like those in our list under number 3. A statement, for example, like that in Psalm 24, verse 2, which says, "He founded the earth upon the seas and established it upon the rivers." Or in Psalm 136, verse 6, we have the statement, "The Lord spread out the earth upon the waters." In order to keep the surrounding waters from overflowing the earth, there were, according to the concept of the people of Old Testament times, encircling mountains at the outer edges of the earth, mountains which served in the capacity of dikes to keep the waters in their proper place. These mountains are designated with the numeral 4 on our diagram, and some, not all, but some of the Old Testament passages which refer to these mountains at earth's outer edges appear in our reference list under that same numeral 4. Notice that the passage in Job 26:11 indicates that these same mountains also serve as the supporting pillars for the firmament or the heavens. And that is why our diagram shows the arch of the firmament resting at either side on these mountains at earth's outer edges, which were also the foundations for the firmament. This firmament, to which we have now referred, is the overarching vault of heaven. It is indicated by the number 5 on our diagram. This firmament was conceived of by the ancient Hebrews as a very solid and substantial arch, capable of supporting great weights and great quantities of water above it, and serving to separate these superterrestrial waters from the waters on the earth below. Biblical references to this firmament are included in our duplicated list under number 5. Notice, for example, how this concept of the firmament as a dividing means between the waters above and below is reflected in the creation account in Genesis chapter 1, beginning at verse 6. "And God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters. And God made the firmament, and separated the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament, and it was so. And God called the firmament heaven, and there was evening, and there was morning, a second day." Items 6, 7, and 8 in our diagram represent the sun, the moon, and the stars. In the thinking of the ancient Hebrews, these heavenly bodies were regarded as being placed into or on the surface of the firmament, perhaps even attached to it in some way, and they were viewed as moving across the face of the firmament in fixed courses or highways. As a matter of fact, the very word which the Hebrew language uses for highway is the word which is used to speak of the course across the face of the firmament which was followed by these heavenly bodies. Reference has already been made to the waters above the firmament, which were part of the ancient Semitic worldview. These waters are indicated on our diagram by the number 9. Since the reference passages, which we thought of and spoke of in connection with the firmament, have already mentioned these waters, we need not repeat them here. They occur, for example, in the passage in Genesis 1, verses 6 to 8, and Psalm 148, verses 4 to 6, which we listed under the references to the firmament under number 5.
These waters above the firmament were apparently regarded as the source of the rain which fell on the earth. Number 10 in our diagram represents the openings at various points in the firmament, openings which serve to allow the waters above to pass through and to come down on the earth in the form of rain. The passages listed under number 10 refer to these openings in the firmament as the windows of heaven, or in some passages they're called the doors of heaven. For example, in the account of the flood, as we have it in Genesis 7, verse 11, we are told, in the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, on the 17th day of the month, on that day, all the fountains of the great deep burst forth, and the windows of the heavens were opened. Genesis 8, also from the flood account, says, the fountains of the deep and the windows of the heavens were closed, and the rain from the heavens was restrained. And this passage refers to the ending of the great deluge of waters which created the flood. In the passage in Psalm 78, verses 23 to 24, these openings in the firmament are called the doors of heaven, as the Lord commanded the skies above and opened the doors of heaven, and he rained down upon them manna to eat. Item number 11 in the diagram endeavors to visualize the Hebrew explanation of the sources of those waters which appear on the face of the earth in the form of rivers and lakes, springs and wells, or any other source or gathering of water. In Semitic thought, these waters on the face of the earth were accounted for by what the Semitic people called the fountains of the great deep. These were openings in the earth through which the waters below the earth were enabled to come to or near the earth's surface. In the passage which we read from the Genesis flood account, the breaking up of these fountains of the great deep, together with the opening of the windows of heaven, supplies the explanation for the appearance of the vast quantities of water which covered the ground in that flood. The ancient Semitic concept of the structure of the physical world seems to have included also the notion of certain storage places above the firmament from which certain elements in nature were let down through the windows or doors of heaven. These are represented in our diagram by the four squares above the firmament, marked with the number 12. These are shown here in our diagram as four in number, simply to reflect the fact that the Old Testament happens to mention at least four such storehouses, namely the storehouses of the rain, the wind, the snow, and the hail. For the Old Testament Hebrew people, Sheol was the name of the place of the dead, or the name of the realm of the dead. This concept of Sheol in the Old Testament is not, strictly speaking, equivalent to what the New Testament speaks of as hell. For in the thought of the Old Testament believers, Sheol was the place for all the dead, the godly as well as the wicked. When this Sheol was conceived of as a place, it was invariably spoken of as being somewhere beneath the surface of the earth, and it was in some way associated with the concept of the great deep in which the foundations of the earth were sunk. This is shown in our diagram marked with the number 13. Typical passages referring to Sheol in the Old Testament, and these are only a few of the very many which occur, are the passages in Numbers chapter 16 verses 31 to 33, and Jonah chapter 2, verses 2 and 3. In these verses, for example, Jonah is quoted as praying as he had been thrown into the sea and thought he was on his way to death. I called to the Lord out of my distress, and he answered me. Out of the belly of Sheol I cried, and thou didst hear my voice. For thou didst cast me into the deep, into the heart of the seas, and the flood was round about me. All thy waves and thy billows passed over me. Beyond the visible heavens or firmament, the people of the Old Testament conceived of the heaven of heavens, which was in a special way associated with the concept of the dwelling place of God. This is represented in our diagram by the lightly shaded area above the heavenly waters, designated by the number 14. Some of the Old Testament passages related to this concept are given in our reference list, including some which express the realization that even the heaven of heavens cannot adequately serve as the dwelling place of the God of all creation. One of the typical passages which speaks of this heaven of heavens as the dwelling place of God is Psalm 29, verse 10, which says, "The Lord sits enthroned over the flood." This is above the waters over the firmament. There, "The Lord sits enthroned over the flood. The Lord sits enthroned as King forever." Or think of Psalm 148, verse 4. "Praise him, you highest heavens, and you waters above the heavens." Now, we should frankly admit that among the Hebrews, there was apparently room for some degree of variation and fluidity in the description of the structure of the world. For example, whereas it seems that the usual understanding was that the earth was basically of circular circumference, something like a saucer, at least one Old Testament passage suggests that some Old Testament people and writers conceived of the earth as being square. We think, for example, of the reference in Isaiah 11, verse 12, which speaks of the four corners of the earth. Also, while the passages that we have referred to have suggested the notion of a flat earth held up by pillars, one Old Testament passage suggests a variant view of this, namely Job 26, verse 7, which states that God stretches out the north over the void and hangs the earth upon nothing. These variants remind us of the fact that in Egypt and Babylonia too, divergent views were held at one and the same time, and quite possibly this was also the case among the ancient Hebrews whom we know as the Israelites of old. By and large, however, from a study of the Old Testament cosmological references, there emerges a fairly consistent picture which, in its basic essentials, seems to have been reasonably close to that which is outlined in our diagram. And let me add that in this diagram, I have tried only to suggest a general pattern, making no claim to have presented here a visualization of Old Testament cosmology, which is the only correct one. Now, let's make some brief comparisons. Comparing the Old Testament cosmology with that of ancient Egypt and ancient Babylonia, what similarities and or contrasts are discernible? Obviously, there are a number of features which they have in common. All three are what we may call phenomenological accounts. That is, they use language which describes things simply as they appear to be to people who have no further means of close examination. All three descriptions, that of the Egyptians, that of the Babylonians, and that of the Israelites, all three agree in locating the Earth on the waters of the great deep, and at least one of the others shares the Old Testament concept of supporting pillars going down into the watery depths. All three share the idea of encircling mountains enclosing the Earth's circumference. Also, they have in common the notion of a vaulted sky or firmament. They also share similar ideas about the movement of the heavenly bodies across the face of the earth. Then, too, they have in common their views about the heavens as the divine dwelling place, as well as of the location of the realm of the dead in a subterranean region. What seems to be indicated then is this, that the biblical writers, when referring to features of the physical world, simply thought and spoke and wrote in terms which were the thought forms and the ways of speaking about the world which were commonly used in the era in which they lived. The biblical writers make no claim to having received any special revelation from God about the physical structure of the world. When they talk about the world, they're talking about the world as they have observed it. And notice, too, they are not teaching science. They use terminology that is understood by the people of their day. And they are simply speaking in the scientific thought forms of the people of their day. Above all else, they use this terminology in order to praise their creating and redeeming God. So in one striking way, then, the Old Testament writers make a complete break with their predecessors and their contemporaries in other nations of the ancient Near East. Their understanding and their descriptions of the structure of the world among the Israelites leave absolutely no room for the erroneous religious ideas or for the numerous gods and goddesses who inhabit and who are part of the structure of the cosmos of ancient Egypt and Babylon. In Israel's view of the world, all pagan elements are absent. All polytheistic notions give way to the monotheism of Israel's religion. And the whole world is seen by the biblical writers in its relationship to Israel's God, who alone is the maker and preserver of heaven and earth and of man, the God who is above all else, the only preserver and gracious redeemer of all mankind. When we now compare the cosmology of the Old Testament with the knowledge of the universe which we have in this 20th century space age, we find that there is a world of difference. Today, we no longer think of a flat earth standing on pillars in water as the Israelites did, but we think of a spherical earth, a round globe spinning out in space. We no longer think of a geocentric universe in which sun, moon, and stars orbit around the earth or move in their courses above the earth. Rather, our present knowledge suggests a heliocentric universe, a sun-centered universe, in which our earth on its spinning axis moves in orbit around the sun. Today, we no longer think of a solid heavenly vault located possibly a dozen or so miles above our head. This is a concept, by the way, which, if it corresponded to reality, would make completely impossible any space shots, since, if they were attempted at all, they could only end up with our astronauts crashing into the firmament above. But now we ask, does this mean, then, that the Bible is now an outmoded or unreliable book, a book which has lost its meaning and significance for us in this space age? Despite the fact that there are those who would answer this question in the affirmative, we must insist nothing could be farther from the truth. For if we correctly understand the purpose for which the Scriptures have been written, then we know that they never intended to teach us science or to give us some kind of eternally valid and reliable scientific picture of the physical world in which we live. The Scriptures intend rather to teach us eternally valid and reliable information about God, our Creator and Redeemer. The Scriptures are written, we must remind ourselves, as St. Paul has told us, they are written to make us wise unto salvation through faith which is in Jesus Christ. Notice the Scriptures say they are written to make us wise, not in the area of science, not in the area of knowledge about the earth, but they are written to make us wise unto salvation. And this teaching, this knowledge of salvation, comes through the Scriptures and is eternally true and correct and reliable, even though such things as the languages or the thought forms or the cosmological views of the biblical writers may no longer be those of our generation. To the Israelite of old, the Genesis accounts of creation said this: look about you. This world in which you live, this world as you know it from your experience and your study, is God's world, a world created by your Maker and Redeemer. And so in the words of Psalm 150, verse 2, the Israelite of old was encouraged, praise him, praise this Creator God for his mighty deeds. To the 20th century space age man, these Genesis accounts and the Old Testament statements about the structure of the world say precisely the same thing, and they will continue to say the same thing even to future generations whose understanding of the structure of the universe will undoubtedly be far advanced over ours. And it is more than likely that our sons and daughters will have an even greater insight to the knowledge of the structure of the physical universe than you and I have today. But even for them, as for us, the Genesis accounts are saying and will continue to say, look about you. This world in which you live, this world as you know it from your experience and your study, is God's world, a world created by your Maker and Redeemer. Praise him for his mighty deeds.